is Jumbie, you're going to want to hit that subscribe button.
With your hosts, myself, Cliff Knight, and Dev Ramsiwak.
On Jumbie, we're going to hear dark and haunting stories from local storytellers that are inspired or about the spirits, monsters, and other cryptids from colonized places.
These are stories that don't often get to be told on larger stages. Not everybody grows up with stories of vampires and werewolves, or at least like the ones you can buy books about.
Then we'll sit in conversation with our storyteller to explore their relationship with their story, with horror, and how colonization ties into any of that. On this episode, we have Ryan Persaudi. Ryan Persaudi is a queer artist, educator, and writer based in Toronto. His work interrogates relationships between queer Indo-Caribbean diasporas, Caribbean feminisms, and legacies of indenture within performance, embodiment, and popular culture. This is Ryan Persaudi, or Tifa Wine, with The Trial.
Trial by Tifa Wine. The spirit or Jumbie of a long-gone indentured laborer whose life, and in some cases child's life as well, was cut too short is known in the Indo-Caribbean as a churail. In Guyana, she's also referred to as a boot or a vampiric supernatural being that lives on in the physical world as the ghost of a harmed deceased Kuli woman. In some stories, she is noted as being killed during childbirth through the act of giving life into the world, while others note she committed suicide during pregnancy for reasons we do not know. In other oral traditions, the child continues to live while the mother has died. In this moment of passing, the churail is so enraged that she cannot be with her child, she cannot rest peacefully, and instead, the separation from her child disrupts her spirit so much that her condition is consumed by anger that can only be expressed through inflicting harm upon other mothers. The churail is usually depicted in tattered clothing, long black messy hair that drapes her face, caught in eternal grief and sorrow, longing for the child that was so painfully taken away from her. She often dresses in all white, holding her unborn baby in her arms, and in the depths of the night, by straining to hear, it has been found that she wails sorrowfully as the unborn child cries into the night and into her. The churail is unable to pass into the next world, eternally damaged by the lingering and haunting grief that only the loss of a child can bring. In Guyana, the terror of the churail is in her disguise. She looks like any other Kuli woman, only decipherable by her feet, which if you can glance upon them are turned backwards, and in other cases flipped upside down. The churail is capable of adapting her form, specifically using conventional beauty to allure lusty men into her arms. It is said that the churail seeks revenge on women and men alike, but especially targets abusive men and ones who seek to harm pregnant Caribbean women. Tales in Trinidad and Guyana noted that her favorite victim is the pregnant woman who she haunts and possesses. Her jealousy is unimaginable as she creeps, maps, and traces the joy of Caribbean mothers as they experience that which the churail so desperately desires. Her being is solely attached to feelings of dangerous envy and inconsolable trauma. Her choice of inflicting harm is said to take the form of causing pregnant women to miscarry, while also harming the father of these children through inflicting illness. The churail also disputes absent fathers and those who were and are abusive to the bearers of life, working to destroy those who even attempt to neglect their offspring. Churails can be found in many places in the Caribbean, but most often can be spotted at a field, near the water, or at a crossroads. Often tied to the traumas of the plantation, the churail wanders and her voice carries through the night to those looking for her. However, once she is found, it is largely impossible to outsmart her. Those who have encountered her have said that crossing water or leaving shoes behind you will save you, as churails do not move through water and instead will spend all night trying to put on shoes that they cannot maneuver with their unforgiving feet.
Welcome back to Jumbie. Before we do anything, I want you guys to go hit that like, subscribe, follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Make sure you go follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Jumbie Pod. Today, we do have a very special guest in the studio. Give it up while you're listening for Ryan Persaudi or Tifa Wine. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm excited.
Thanks. Jeez, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story with us. The listeners have just heard more research, but yeah, we're going to get into some questions about you and your relationship to this story. But before we do that, yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about your background, your cultural background?
Yeah, so my dad is from San Fernando, Trinidad and Tobago. I'm mixed race, so my mom is actually not Caribbean. She's from Portugal. But I grew up a lot with my cousins on my dad's side and with my grandparents on both sides, but spent a lot of time with my Trini family doing things like going to soca fets, you know, like basement jams, you know, all those sorts of things. Chief of Wine is literally like a middle-aged tanti. And so so a lot of my work speaks back to the Caribbean and the queer Caribbean and the Indo-Caribbean. And sort of the sort of archives of knowledge that all those spaces hold. Yeah,
for sure. And yeah, kind of the whole point of this podcast is getting back down to the roots of some of these and like understanding more what we might have missed, you know, seeing ways that it probably has evolved over time. I'm going to ask, what's your relation to this story or this myth?
I knew of Charles before, but as I was just saying, I don't come from a Hindu or a Muslim Indo-Caribbean family, which is often like the mainstream kind of dominant representation you often have.
Yeah.
So my grandparents were like very, very pious Christians. And it was actually interesting because they always had this, not all of them, but they had this sort of disdain toward Hindu communities. Like it was almost like, and I think it's a lot of that is internalized colonialism about we're not like those people. Don't be like those people. And I think for them, maybe Hindus represented a kind of backwards, indentured, historical coolie past. Whereas, you know, especially in the context of Trinidad, a lot of Christians were forcibly converted by the British in order to socially mobilize, right? Yeah. So your marriage was not legible in Trinidad for like decades, and unless you were Christian, therefore meaning your children would not be legible citizens, right? So a lot of people, especially in San Fernando, were actually converted. It's actually really wild that I'm also in Canada now because the Canadian Presbyterian Church was the one that converted all these coolies. So it's kind of interesting now to like be born and raised in Canada. And so Canada's always kind of had their foot in the door.
I did not realize it was the Canadian Presbyterian Church. Because my family as well, both my Gainu side and my Trini side are Christians. And like very, very much so. Like my grandparents were like, we were supposed to go to church every weekend. Like my parents were a little bit more lax, but the only reason we are not more religious in my family was my brother and I grew up here. Yeah. My brother became a hardcore atheist as a teenager, like 12 years old, questioning my mother on everything, and she has no answers, and that's really the only reason. But I remember talking to my mom about wanting to learn about Hinduism as a culture, as a religion, a little bit more, not even convert, just like learn about it. And she got so offended, like why, she literally said, but they're so backwards and all of this. And we didn't end up having a conversation about like why she sort of felt that way, but it definitely is like a major cultural thing. Because I know as well, in order to have own land in Trinidad, you had to convert to Christianity.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I've thought about a lot in terms of that, and like why my family probably didn't share some of these like non-Christian stories with me as a child and stuff like that. Like why I had to go like looking for it.
Yeah, like my grandma, she only mentioned it once. She used to like come to my parents' house when I was a teenager, and she would like spend like a week with us, like during Easter or like whatever. We would just like hang out, and she would just like tell me all these stories. And like this was just kind of like a passing sort of thing, but she was also a very God-fearing person. So I think it was more with the aim of being like, you know, like don't be bad. Like she used to always say like to me, like, are you acting proper? Like that was like always her language. And that was also, I think, coding for like don't be gay. But like also I think it was to do with respectability and like modesty and sort of these very like Christian and very, I want to say like also like coolly masculinity ways of being like a boy or being a man, or what she understood as being a man, right? But I remember hearing these stories through a realm of, you know, of like fear and paranoia, and not so much as like, oh, this is like really creepy and cool. It was also like when I was thinking about the trial, I remember, and this is, you know, trigger warning, this is very anti-Black, but I remember I had one aunt who was Dogla, meaning, for anyone who doesn't know, that she has mixed Black and Indian ancestry in the Caribbean. And I remember, like, when my grandfather died, like, her husband, there was this one, and I'd never seen her before, never met this woman before, but apparently she had met me when I was, like, a month old, and, like, she knew who I was.
You didn't remember her? Yeah. She held you when you were this small.
I know. But I remember my grandma, like, fully pulled me aside, and she was like, be careful with that woman. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, she does jadu. And I was like, what? Because I just thought it was so ridiculous for it to hear this, like, word come out of my grandma's mouth, who was, like, super religious, super Christian. And she was like, oh, no, no, like, she does witchcraft. Like, be careful with her.
She has confirmation that she does.
Apparently. Yeah. Apparently. But I remember, like, going to my dad after it. I was like, why did she? Like, I used to call my grandma Ma, right? So I was like, why did Ma say that? And he was like, oh, she doesn't make stuff up all the time. But, like, she was really serious. Like, I think a lot of it also had to do with anti-blackness, because most of her generation of people married other coolie people. And so I think there was an era of, like, direct anti-black racism that comes with that, as do many stories in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just interesting to kind of hear that language come out of her mouth. And I was just like, whoa. And she kind of, when I was thinking about the trial, I was like, she never fully said trial, but this kind of witchy figure, you know, she would kind of hit at Eric here and there. It was super strange to hear, like, at a funeral, like, of all places.
I think part of this myth comes, or could be attributed, I'm sort of guessing here, especially in a time where, yeah, parts of the culture of Hindus and whatnot, is that they would have arranged marriages, and possibly it wouldn't be, you know, to the bride's liking. So it's like, yeah, if you were pregnant or whatever, you don't want to have this child. You don't even want to be in this marriage. So it's very, you know, likely it's like, probably take steps to not have this baby themselves, you know, or like, yeah, as you said, part of the research, like, they would commit suicide before coming to terms. So it's like, yeah, you would need to have some sort of cultural warning for this sort of thing. It's like, yeah, even though if you have an arranged marriage, you don't make sure it goes well, or you're just going to come back as this spirit of vengeance and be, you know, or have one chase you or anything like that. So there's definitely parts of this where it feels like it's created within that marginalized culture, but then also probably propagated by, you know, colonialists who were there. It's just like, of course, yeah, that's what you believe it.
Yeah.
I'm, like, really glad you actually chose this story, because it brings to mind such, like, the weird complexities of, like, yeah, patriarchy and stuff like that within the Caribbean. And this was a large part of why I did disconnect from, like, Caribbean culture very early on. I grew up in the suburbs, so my only experience with Caribbeans really was with my family, like, specifically Indo-Caribbeans, was with my family, who were, you know, one, very racist, and two, anytime you kind of questioned them on patriarchy, on racism, or anything, it was very much like, oh, well, that's the culture back home, so, like, it's okay if I do it. And it would very much be like, oh, okay, well, if that's the culture, then I don't really want to do that.
Right.
But when I was like, because I've read up on the Churel a little bit before this, and what I really noticed was, like, yeah, like, she goes after abusive men.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, in that I do feel like there is this, like, tension between in the Caribbean of wanting to have these, you know, female figures who do, like, push back and are very, like, very much like matriarchal leaders in their communities, but also having this patriarchal resistance to that, in which it's like, well, women aren't really supposed to be like that. So if you're like that, you must also be like a witch or a demon or, a jumping. So, yeah, I know that your work as a scholar as well, as an academic, ties into this a little bit. And you have also kind of looked into this for your own photo series that you did called Kulileen. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, no, this, like, works really well, because even the trial, so I produced this series, I think I started in 2019, or maybe 2018, where I was thinking through this sort of paradox, or this juxtaposition of pain and pleasure, that I think is, like, really central to Caribbean lived realities right now. And particularly when I started thinking about this, I was thinking about really real issues in our community, and this is the wider Caribbean community, but I also was thinking specifically through the queer Caribbean and sort of this sort of marginalizations and struggles that are happening right now. And one of them for me was domestic abuse and gendered violence that happens in specifically Indo-Caribbean communities, just last week, another woman was killed by an intimate partner in the GTA. And I was seeing this happen again and again and again. And what I was really, you know, your question of like my work as an academic really fueled my work as a drag artist. Like they went hand in hand, because as I was doing research for my own scholarly work, I was mind blown by all these historical connections between the past and the present that really haven't escaped us, right? And so I was reading this one book by Gayatri Bahadur, who's a journalist in New York City, and the book is called Coolie Woman, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can also talk about this language of coolie. A lot of people don't like the word. Mm-hmm. I find the word is really important in the diaspora for thinking about, again, this juxtaposition of pain and pleasure, but also reclamation and power and agency that's particularly rooted in Caribbean feminist sort of knowledges, right? Where Caribbean feminist women, whether they identify that way or not, have always been at the forefront of teaching us what it means to reclaim your body, to mash up the space, to free up yourself. But all of these ideas around free up are also loaded in pain, right? And so this, in enacting pleasure, we have to also think through what pain has been cost to allow that pleasure to happen, right? And so I was really interested in like images of the horror and the grotesque and the paranormal to help us think through those sorts of intimacies and those sorts of relationships. And so, you know, when I was thinking about the trial, I was thinking specifically about, you know, the ways in which Afro and Indo-Caribbean women have always been rendered as carnal or aggressive in different racialized capacities, right? But have been aggressive, carnal, over the top, unruly, whatless, like all these terms have been used to describe Caribbean women because they have been seen as sort of the antithesis or the opposite of the normative white femininity, right? And specifically the Tanti, right? Like I'm obsessed with Tantis because they're unruly. They will like tell you you're fat. They will like come for you, but then they will also like fight for you the hardest, right?
Can you describe what you mean by Tanti?
Sure. So a Tanti, I guess for anyone who's Caribbean knows what that word means, but it's really just an anti-figure. But Tantis can be made...
Not necessarily your, like, relation.
Yeah.
Auntie. It's just...
They can be.
Who you call auntie.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, I literally have this, like, article coming out, like, in a couple months called Tanti Feminisms to think about. A Tanti can be made, like, through a best friend or through a cousin, or it can be, like, a queer and trans person who has, like, who's an elder in your life, right? That works through this archive of, like, strong and assertive femininity, right? In a particular way. I was interested in all these sorts of tropes of resilience and revolutionary practice that are like rooted in the queer Caribbean. And I'm just using figures that are scary to talk about that, right? Because I think they're really central to kind of Caribbean knowledge systems. And when we think about strong, fierce, you know, queer creators or queer figures in the Caribbean, they often take the shape of the Tanti or take the shape of someone like the Chirayel. And like, what would, if we were to read the Chirayel as a source of Indo-Caribbean or queer Caribbean or just Caribbean feminist knowledge, like what would she offer to us in those conversations?
Yeah, I think that's like really cool.
I mean, you are a performer and whatnot. What made you start getting into live performance?
Oh my, this sounds so bad, but literally RuPaul's Drag Race. Like, I hate the show now. I hate the show. But like, as a young gay, I like was obsessed with it. Like, I literally watched it like ridiculously.
The early seasons are good.
The early seasons. Yeah. Not, it's changed now. But that was, I mean, I'm from Mississauga. And so like, there weren't really any like drag bars to go to. But I mean, I was always in like, you know, I was like an arts kid. I was in music and drama. So I was always really obsessed with like makeup and fashion and like exuberance and extraness and like all those sorts of things. And so then when I just saw drag, I was like, okay, there's something really exciting about what is happening there. Because also the drag artists I cling to are like not people who adhere to like traditional femininity or like cis understandings of what gender is. Like, my favorite drag queen of all time is Nina Flowers. If anybody knows who she is, she was on season one of Drag Race and like doesn't look like any conventional gendered person whatsoever, right? Like is bald, has a bunch of tattoos, but her like eye makeup is half her face, super heavy contours. I'm like, that's the drag that I like. That is like extra and exuberant and hyperbolic and really fucks with gender in a lot of ways and notions of what we think gender is. And so, yeah, I literally started doing drag just like in my bedroom. Like there was like no really where to go to do it at the time. And I just would like take pictures. And then when I moved back to Toronto, I would like go to bars and stuff for fun. And then, yeah, literally I started performing because an organizer, and I hope she doesn't hate me for putting her up here, but Anuradha Verma, who runs Cutie by Puck Saga, was organizing a show. And literally my first gig was at Pride Toronto, which is wild. Because most queens or kings or artists go to like open stages.
Go to something first.
Yeah. And she was like, do you want to perform in front of like 200 people? And I was like, sure. I don't know what I was doing. But I did this whole, like, what was the number? You know the song Pipe? The Soca song Pipe? But the whole song is literally, like, do you want some pipe? Do you want some pipe? Like, right. It's, like, a play on, like, yeah. dick, basically. Mm-hmm. And, again, it was from a woman's voice. And so this, like, hyper excessive sexuality was, like, literally my first number. And then, yeah, from there, I just, like, my work became really entangled with my research work. And so, you know, I'm really committed to doing, like, educational spaces and outreach and community engagement and that sort of thing. As well as, you know, performing in the clubs. And the clubs are an important space as well. But I think in the city, too, the clubs sometimes miss the sort of radical potential of drag.
I mean, so. Based on my experience in performing in live spaces in Toronto, the clubs, once again, do not really care. They kind of just care about the drink sales.
Yeah.
Usually, if you can sell some tickets and bring the people in, they'll be like, yeah, sure. What is it? Churail? Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You have to, like, there's only certain sorts of numbers you can do. In the clubs, and especially in the spaces that you're in. So most of the spaces I perform in are usually not in the village. I think I performed in the village maybe like 5 times on my whole like 5-year career. Most of the spaces I do are like, you know, with other like-minded political thinkers and performers. So.
Okay. What specifically do you see going forward? Like, do you see any changes in the myth? Like anybody doing any particular takes that you notice that you like or something that you might want to do?
In drag, I haven't actually seen it. I mean, also, there aren't that many, like, Indo-Caribbean drag artists in Toronto. But I have seen, there's a lot of storytellers. So, like, a lot of my work that I was, when I was trying to understand and put together this photograph that you mentioned, was, like, again, I had to go back to the oral traditions that mostly are rooted in the Caribbean, right? So, it's very hard to find writing in the trial. And most of them are, like, from, like, blogs or, like, stories mm-hmm. or oral traditions that, like, people have told. And so, like, when I did that picture, like, I remember even there was a person in the Caribbean that was like, oh no, your trial was like very like glamorous. Because she was like, when I heard of the trial, like the trial is supposed to be like messy and like ugly and like haunted and all these sorts of things. And so, you know, mine was a very kind of diasporic drag imagining of what the trial would look like. You know, I was wearing like, you know, like a synthetic wig and like glitter and like all these sorts of things. But again, the trial can, you know, is obviously a manifestation of people's imagination. I also have never met one in real life, and I don't know if I want to. So it's kind of my kind of reading based on my research and people's stories. But there's, you know, there's, I mean, even with your podcast, there's a lot of people I think that have always been interested in the horrific, right? And the grotesque as a kind of political resource. Particularly, I think for me, I mean, I did the Sukoyan, I did the trial, and I like also made up some characters. But it was to help us to think about particularly Caribbean feminism. And what, you know, decolonial efforts and lessons of the Caribbean offers us. So, you know, when I was thinking about the trial, I was like, it's also this representative metaphor for the ways in which women of color in the Caribbean have been, again, rendered as like too much, excessive, too loud, in need of regulation and control. And the trial is uncontrollable, mm-hmm. right? Like, she doesn't give a fuck about men, right? And so that kind of was my lesson too, to like, to think through that archive of Caribbean womanhood and femininity and gendering that has always been fierce and in your face and over the top, and which is really, I think, important for, especially for me as like a cis queer person to draw upon that legacy.
It's odd though that what they've gone ahead and done is just like all women, the weakness of the churail is shoes. So
I did want to ask about, you brought something up, and that is, how do you think like engaging with these stories and with this particular type of storytelling, like using fear and horror and the grotesque, how does engaging with that from the diaspora help us make those connections back to our culture and like back to our building relationships with folks who maybe aren't in the diaspora?
Yeah, and I mean, I think in my work too, I try and get away from this whole like home away sort of binary, right? Like in that I don't want to play into discourse that's like, we're in Canada, therefore we're not real Caribbeans, therefore, you know, we're inauthentic, because all those sorts of diaspora wars I just find are really exhausting. Mm-hmm. And it's just identity politics. And so, you know, I'm also of the training that the Caribbean is made far beyond the territories of the Caribbean, right? And the diaspora is part of the Caribbean always. Like a city like Toronto is a Caribbean city. Right.
Yeah.
You know, when we think about like Soca, like so many Soca artists come here in New York to like to record their music and then go back and tour all over the world. And so I don't see Toronto as separated from the Caribbean. Obviously, the lives people are living here are different. And I don't want to say they're the same. But I think we've always been in conversation with one another. And I think that's really the important work of doing these sorts of things because it helps us to make those connections that are outside of like one place as the authentic or being here as the inauthentic. My work sometimes troubles people because I also don't give a fuck about India and I never have. And I know, I think a lot of people who hear the word Kuli, especially like, I don't know, certain communities have more of an attachment, I think, to like the motherland, whatever you want to call that. But, you know, in my work too, I always talk about how Indo-Caribbeanness is made in our departure from India, right? Mm-hmm. And so that may also be because of my own political training for the people that have trained me, but also because I'm someone whose father is like fifth, sixth, I don't even know, but he's like five or six generations removed from India. And so like we had no connection. Also, my grandparents like didn't care about India, right? Like they would always, they would really never say like they're Indians. They would always say they're Trinis, right? Mm, yeah. And not to like buy into like nationalist politics, but also I think that helps us to get away from this like trauma porn stuff that's really pervasive in like Indo-Caribbean diasporic whatever. Like there are so many blogs and things that are like, we need to go back to India. And it's like, they never wanted us. So I don't know why we're trying to like fight for someone's...
There ain't space.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And so I think that's why also the work is called Kuliween, because I really want to honor the labor diaspora that we come out of. Yeah. Right? That is so... That is literally built on the backs of those who are... That were indentured laborers. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Like I think we forget that like we descend from like sex workers and people who were criminalized and hyper-policed and hyper-surveilled. Like we didn't come from like lavish, like Bollywood-esque, like lenga wearing, you know, like it's like so weird when I see these images of even like Indian Arrival Day where like people were like wearing lengas and I'm like, our people didn't wear that. Mm-hmm. Like they were not wearing that.
The people who were brought to the Caribbean were not the ones wearing that, specifically because of India's very rigid caste system. Yeah, nobody who would have been wearing that would have been allowed to even get on one of those ships.
Yeah, and so I think it's really important to center like the history of the Kuli because we are not the same as sort of this like South Asian national imagination. Also, India's a fascist state. So yeah. I don't know why we're trying to like fit into something that has never given a care about us, but also is working to like harm people all across the continent.
Right now.
And yeah, and I'm like, I think we really need to center more about labor in our conversations of Indo-Caribbeans because we only come to the region through labor. Mm-hmm. Right? And through the work of particular types of communities.
For sure. Yeah, I do like what you mentioned that the Caribbean people who are living here in Toronto and the ones back in the Caribbean are kind of the same, but specifically I used to take note of how every Caribbean person who comes to Canada, they're already a Raptors fan because all their aunties live here and they send back the barrels full of Raptors gear and basketballs and all this kind of, so that's like our first basketball team, you're gonna, apart from the Bulls, of course. But like it's, yeah, this kind of like sharing of culture, even though people get here and they don't give a shit about cricket anymore, you know, unless you're in a team or something, but it's like very specific, like we are going to share that culture back and forth and find a connection anywhere we can. Like, yeah, Scotiabank's taken over Caravana, but, like, it's still we take, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, also Scotiabank is, like, literally all over the Caribbean, like, commodifying space all the time. Yeah. So is CIBC. So Canada has always had a foot in the door of the Caribbean.
Yeah, I remember seeing a post from one of the, like, Indo-Caribbean history Instagrams that I started following recently about the, like, Robin Hood flower and how that's actually a Canadian brand, but everybody uses it home because that's what was imported. It's, like, the brand everyone talks about. And I do think that's, you bring up such a great point about this relationship with Canada and the Caribbean itself. But I don't think we have the time to get into that conversation. You mentioned, like learning from storytellers and things like that. And I wanted to ask if you had any specific storytellers or academics or writers and any folks who are doing this work currently, especially that you've drawn from, that you might want to like shout out or tell us about, because I think it's, we have a hard time finding each other sometimes. I'm always seeking out, just like more work around this to just see what everybody else is thinking.
It's kind of a hard question because I think there are a lot of people doing this work in different capacities. I would say like a lot of my sort of, like when I think about storytelling, I don't necessarily think about, I mean, there's oral traditions that I draw upon, but oftentimes those oral traditions come to me from my own family or they come to me through like research that I've done. I mean, I'm also like a music person and like soca and chutney is always like the knowledge carrier for so much of the things that I do. And I think it's also because as a drag artist, I predominantly perform soca and chutney. Mm-hmm. And so I think about all these sort of political stories that are deeply embedded in this art form that often gets cast as like very apolitical and like joyful and fun loving, and but it's deeply, deeply like revolutionary, mm-hmm. right? And so I think, yeah, a lot of my sort of, I guess, genealogy of storytelling comes through that sort of archive as well. The thing is, I feel like sometimes in doing this work is cool. I mean, like, I don't know that many people doing it, especially through drag, right? So maybe I'll have to get back to you on that one. There's a writer who's actually a friend of mine based in Scarborough, named Natasha Ramutar, who's Guyanese. She just published a book, a poetry collection last year. Oh my God, what is it?
Bittersweet,
yes.
I have it on the shelf, like, right behind me.
Yeah, so she's amazing. We actually just wrote a piece together for the Starbrook News, I think, 2 weeks ago. She's really great. Also, Rahav Mohabir is really great, who does a lot of work with like chutney poetry. Alia Khan is an academic who does really, really great work with sort of these archives of indenture. I really enjoy her work too. But yeah, I think there's a ton of people working in like different capacities that are really, all really critical in doing the work. But maybe I'll get back to you. I'll have to think of some more names and I'll give you some. Yeah.
Well, I think that's all we really have time
that's
for.
That's all we have time for today. Where can people check out more of your work? Where can they find you?
Yeah, so most of my stuff is on Instagram at tifa.wine. I'm also on Twitter as at Rai Prasadi. And I also have a website, my academia website, if anyone's interested in research.
For people researching, go check it out. Of course, everything will be linked in the show notes. Once again, make sure you go like, subscribe, follow, find us on Instagram and Twitter at JumbiePod. My name is Cliff Knight. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter at CliffySoFunny. Where can people find you, Deb?
Also on Instagram and Twitter at Murky Waters and various with or without the underscore, type in Dev Ramsubak, you'll find me.
Nice. Once again, thank you, Ryan, for coming through.
Thanks for having me.
We hope to check out your events sometime soon. We're definitely going to give people an update on that. Thanks, everyone, once again, for listening to Jumbie, and don't forget to check those dark corners.
You are listening to Jumbie. Produced by Dev Ramsewak, hosted by Cliff Knight, music by Z Thompson. Sound effects are Creative Commons sounds from freesound.org. Make sure you're subscribed so you can catch our next episode.
We'll be featuring Joan Rupram.
We can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and a bunch of other different directories. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to check those dark, shadowy corners.